this morning we are in lesson 9 in our study of Job.
We're going to be looking in just a few minutes at chapters 27 through 31. Those chapters essentially comprise two monologues that Job engages in after essentially the debate with his friends has ended. In the last class, in lesson 8, I indicated that I really wanted to spend just a little bit of time talking about the last two questions of lesson 8. And we're going to do that this morning. This is where we are in lesson 9, though. We've completed the dialogue with the friends, where Job's three friends are speaking and Job responds to them. We noted in the last class, lesson 8, that Zophar doesn't have a third speech. We'll say a little bit more about that in this lesson as we talk about Job's monologue. So chapters 27 through 31 are these two monologues, and we'll summarize them quickly because we're not going to be able to talk about that many chapters in any great detail. But I do want to go back to the last lesson where Job's friends are finishing up their dialogue with Job, and particularly in chapter 24. In the ESV, unfortunately, verse 1 is not particularly clear. Maybe from reading the rest of the chapter, you could get the sense of what Job is trying to say. We'll look at some different translations of that verse. The NLT says, why doesn't the Almighty bring the wicked to judgment? Why must the godly wait for him in vain? So Job is questioning why the wicked don't get punished sometimes for the things they do. According to the NLT, always a paragon of translational accuracy. God's Word translation, why doesn't the Almighty set aside times for punishment? And that's the problem. The ESV is kind of cryptic when it says, why do those who know him see not his days? What days? Well, the days of punishment for the wicked. And then continuing with some other translations, the New International, why doesn't the Mighty One set a time for judging sinful people? Why do those who know him have to keep waiting for that day? Well, you can understand the consternation in the minds of people who think that when you're wicked, that you're going to suffer. When you're righteous, you're going to prosper. And yet, what do you see? You see the wicked getting away with their lifestyle without God punishing them. And that's how Job talks for the remainder of the chapter. He talks not just about the wicked taking advantage of the poor and helpless, but the helpless who are suffering. He says in chapter 24 and verse 2, some remove landmarks. They seize flocks violently and feed on them. They drive away the donkey of the fatherless, the orphan. They take the widow's ox as a pledge. They push the needy off the road. All the poor of the land are forced to hide, indeed like wild donkeys in the desert. They go out to their work searching for food. The wilderness yields food for them and for their children. He goes on. He talks about the wicked and all the things that they do. Verse 13, there are those who rebel against the light. They do not know its ways nor abide in its paths. The murderer rises with the light. He kills the poor and needy, and in the night he's like a thief. And yet they seem to be getting away with all of this. And when he gets done, look at verse 20. Let's go back to verse 24, 22 of chapter 24. But God draws the mighty away with his power. He rises up, but no man is sure of life. He gives them security, and they rely on it. Yet his eyes are on their ways. They are exalted for a little while, then they are gone. They are brought low. They are taken out of the way like all others. They dry out like the heads of grain. Now, if it is not so, who will prove me a liar and make my speech worth nothing? Job says, tell me that this isn't what happens. Tell me that the wicked who have power don't take advantage of the poor. And of course, we see that all around us today. That's not any great new truth. And Job is calling his friends' attention to that. So that question, I've got some verses up there that we read some of those already. We'll not comment on them too much. But Job's point is going to destroy the friends' argument. What is their argument? that suffering always comes to those who sin, the wicked, and in proportion to their wickedness. And Job is just saying that's not true, not in an absolute sense. Now, I'm going to point out, as we talk about Zophar's purported third speech, at least according to some commentators, that Job, I think, in the beginning believed that same thing as the three friends, although he's come to question their theodicy. But at the same time, Job agrees with that general principle. I think he said it over and over again, that the wicked are going to be punished by God. His wondering is, why am I being punished since I'm not wicked? And why is it that sometimes it doesn't seem like the wicked get the punishment when they should? Well, those are important questions for us. When somebody's suffering in this life and they don't feel like they deserve it, why did God allow this to happen? How come God's letting so-and-so do so well and we know that that person is living in some sort of ungodly fashion? Well, those are the questions that Job was asking. So that's question seven. What seems to be Bildad's point in his short speech? I said earlier that it seems like as the speeches go on, the friends start to shorten their speeches a little bit, and it's like they've run out of soap. And Bildad's speech is six verses long. If you look there in verse 25, that's the summation of his speech. Dominion and fear belong to him. He makes peace in his high places. Is there any number to his armies? Upon whom does his light not rise? God knows everything. He's all powerful. How then can man be righteous before God? Or how can he be pure who is born of a woman? It seems to me that his speech is essentially a rebuke to Job, or at least the proclamation that man really can't be righteous before God. Not in an absolute sense. And so everybody's going to suffer. All men suffer. If the moon doesn't shine and the stars are not pure in his sight, how much less man who is a maggot and a son of man who is a worm? So Bildad's just saying, listen, it's inevitable that we're going to sin, and so we're going to suffer as a result. Okay? Comments or questions about any of these two things? Bildad's speech here in chapter 25 is the last speech of the friends. And so now, of course, Job is going to answer Bildad's speech in chapter 26, and then he'll begin his monologues there in chapter 27. What I want to do this morning is look at those monologues in chapters 27 to 31 and listen to how Job describes his past life compared to his present condition. He'll talk a little bit about wisdom. I think maybe Bildad is also saying in his last speech here that really man can't know. And the fact of the matter is, Job agrees that wisdom comes from God. Man's not going to discover it on his own. Also, I want to talk a little bit about Zophar's third speech. Because there are some commentators who believe that the text here should be divided a little bit different, and I want to at least give you some explanation of why I think that that's not the case. So I ask you to look at several passages there, and you notice that goes all the way back to the beginning of Job's response to Eliphaz in the first cycle of speeches and on down through chapter 27, 1 through 6. What do all those passages have in common? And here's the answer. It's we could read all these passages. I'm not going to do that. What I would like to do is summarize them. Someone says, why'd you put them up there if you're not going to read them? Oh, there. Did you read that? We really don't have time. So let me just summarize some of the major points by pulling out phrases from those passages. And you're going to see a theme here. In these replies, in the words of Job. In chapter 6, 29 through 30, he says, my righteousness still stands. 10:7, you know that I'm not guilty. 12:4, a just and blameless man, describing himself. 13, I know that I shall be in the right. 16, no violence in my hands and my prayer is pure. chapter 23, verses 1 through 12, several things he says there. An upright man, he describes himself, I shall come out as gold when I am tested by the Lord. Job has this firm conviction that eventually God's going to reverse his fortunes, that God's going to recognize that he has not committed wickedness commensurate with the suffering that he is enduring. I have kept his way, he says in verse 11, and have not turned aside. That's 23:11. I've not departed from the commandment of his lips. Part of the frustration of the friends is that Job will not admit what they believe has to be true. That Job has to have sinned because that's the only explanation for his suffering. We know differently, obviously, because we are privy to chapters 1 and 2. But the friends are frustrated with that because Job continues to affirm his innocence. And remember how God describes him in the beginning. I don't think Job is claiming something that's not true, although in his monologues, as we'll note here in just a little bit, I think he goes a little overboard in affirming his righteousness. But nevertheless, God said there's nobody like him. He's a just and upright man who turns from evil. Follows God's commandments. Chapter 27, part of our text for today. I will not put away my integrity from you. I'm not going to say that I'm a sinner to please you friends if I'm not really guilty. I hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go, in verse 6. My heart does not reproach me for any of my days. You know who that sounds like? The Apostle Paul in chapter 23 of Acts in verse 1, where he says, I've lived in all good conscience until this day. Paul wasn't saying he was sinless, but he lived in good conscience. He tried to do what he thought was right. And Job makes much the same claim. So all of these passages affirm, Job is affirming his innocence, his righteousness. And of course, in the sense not of being perfect, but not deserving the punishment that he had received. I've got some of this repeated, not sure why. I'll get with Debbie and see if we can correct that. All right, so any comments about any of that before we go on to question two? Yeah, David?
I think it's interesting in Job 6, 29 through 30, at the end, mm-hmm. Cannot my palate discern the cause of calamity? I think he's saying, I can tell when sin is the cause, but his problem, I think, is that when Satan first killed his children and all that sort of thing, he could look and say, oh, those are the evil men that did that. When it touched his body, who can he blame?
Right.
He can only blame God, because that's all he knows as far as who might have caused his body, or what an evil man that did that to him.
I think that's a good comment. Verse 28 says, of chapter 6, but now be pleased to look at me, speaking to his friends, for I will not lie to your face. Please turn. Let no injustice be done. Turn now. My vindication is at stake. Is there any injustice on my tongue? Cannot my palate discern the cause of calamity? Don't you think I would know if I was sinful? Go ahead. Tell me where my sin is. Take a look at my life and identify sin. Now, Eliphaz eventually will do that. He'll invent some sins, as we studied in the last class in Lesson 8. Eliphaz's last speech, he basically blasts Job and says, you did this and you did that and you weren't kind to people. You took advantage of the helpless. He doesn't know that about Job, but he's got to make Job a sinner in order for his theology to remain consistent, to be vindicated. All right. Other comments or questions? Anybody? So let's go on to question number two. I don't know about you, but I'm one of these persons who likes order and structure. I like symmetry. And the fact that Zophar doesn't have a third speech just aggravates some people to no end. He's got to have a third speech because that completes the three cycles. Well, let me point out some things. First of all, the text doesn't identify any material as belonging to Zophar. You've probably noticed consistently that in the speeches by the friends and the replies by Job, there's kind of an introductory line there. And Job said, or Job replied, or Job continued his words, etc. Or Eliphaz says, we've been identifying these speeches all along based on what the text says. There is no textual indication that Zophar has a third speech. Part of the reason that this material, particularly Job 27, 13 through the end of the chapter, part of the reason that some people want to assign that to Zophar is because it sounds like Zophar, something Zophar would say. Let's take a look at chapter 27. Of course, folks will say that chapter 27, 1 through 12, yeah, that's Job, because at the beginning it says, moreover, Job continued his discourse and said, so he's responding to Bildad. And then look at verse 13. This is the portion of a wicked man with God, and the heritage of oppressors received from the Almighty. If his children are multiplied, it's for the sword, and his offspring shall not be satisfied with bread. Those who survive him shall be buried in death, and their widow shall not weep. Though he heaps up silver like dust and piles up clothing like clay, he may pile it up, but the just will wear it, and the innocent will divide the silver. So if he becomes more prosperous, it just ends up going to the righteous. He builds his house like a moth, like a booth which a watchman makes. The rich man will lie down, but not be gathered up. He opens his eyes, and he is no more. Terrors overtake him like a flood. A tempest steals him away in the night. The east wind carries him away, and he's gone. It sweeps him out of his place. It hurls against him and does not spare. He flees desperately from its power. Men shall clap their hands at him. That's a sign of disapproval. That sort of idea, and shall hiss him out of his place. Does that sound like something Zophar would say? Absolutely. That's what the three friends have been saying all along. The wicked man, he's going to suffer. Now here's the question. Does Job believe that same thing? Does Job believe that the wicked will suffer or should suffer? What's the difference between Job's view and the friend's view now as we've come along and had this discussion? What's the difference between their two views? Well, it's simple. It's very simple. The friends believe it's an absolute thing. There are no exceptions to that rule. If you're wicked, you're going to suffer. If you're righteous, you're going to prosper. What Job has pointed out to the friends and continues to affirm, is that sometimes that rule doesn't work. That sometimes in this life, it seems like the wicked do prosper. Sometimes they seem to get away with their sins. And sometimes the helpless, the poor, the righteous even, they end up suffering. So Paul is normally in the New Testament in the ESV, but then he's in the Old Testament in the New Living Translation. Job then says, wait a second, there are exceptions to what you're saying. And the friends will not admit that. The most that they will say is that the wicked may prosper for a while, but God's going to get them and make sure that they are punished for their wickedness. Yeah, David?
Looks to me like he's quoting exactly what their position is, and then he starts in chapter 28 and says, well, let's see where wisdom actually comes from.
Okay, that's possible. In fact, one of the theories about chapter 27, the last half of it, is that actually Job is being sarcastic and he's repeating their arguments. And so it is Job speaking, but he's basically taking the words out of their mouths in somewhat of a sarcastic way. I'm not sure I agree with that, but it is a possibility. Job has quoted them before. I just don't see the sarcasm here. I see kind of an affirmation more. But that, you know, sometimes the difference between those two things is pretty small. Ralph?
I didn't go back and compare all the speeches. He uses a lot of third person. He uses a lot of third person type of dialogue. Mm-hmm. It's not me and my. It's a lot of he. And that's what I thought you might be going for, but
okay, I'm not totally sure I understand your comment. Job, you think Job is talking about...
Well, if you ask why would some think it was Zophar as opposed to Job,
right.
Maybe because of the third person
Oh, okay, okay.
Conversation as opposed to Job, me and my.
Yeah, we might expect if it was Job speaking that he would use first person, I, that sort of thing. Well, but he's describing the wicked man. So I think he would do that in the third person. He certainly wouldn't describe himself in the first person as wicked. What? You're not English?
No.
Who else? Anybody? Okay, so Job is identified as the speaker in the beginning of the chapter. Speakers seem to always be identified throughout the book. But they're not. There isn't any indication. There's no manuscript evidence. You know, sometimes in comparing manuscripts of Old Testament books, even New Testament books, you'll see small differences. And those variations occasionally can make some difference in how we understand things. But that's not the case here. There's no manuscript over here of the book of Job. And over in here, Zophar gets a third speech. We just keep looking for it. It's not there. So I think the best thing to do is go with the text as it's identified and assume that Zophar, when it came his time to speak, went like this. Yeah, and didn't say anything. And so Job then continues in chapters 27, 28, and through 31 with his two monologues. All right, comments or questions about any of this so far? Okay. Is there anybody who's just really upset that Zophar didn't get a third speech? Okay, question number three. Why might Job have said the things contained in the latter part of the chapter? Well, we've kind of expressed the answer to that, haven't we? He's not opposed to the idea that wicked suffer and that righteous are blessed by God. He firmly believes that God blesses those who are righteous. So what's said in the latter part of the chapter, as long as it's not taken in an absolute sense with no exceptions, Job's already said that, even in the past. So I think the objection that Job has is that they are characterizing him as a sinner without knowing anything about his sins in particular. And of course, he has been proclaiming his innocence. The last paragraph up there, David Williams, some suggest that Job was actually quoting the friends in a sarcastic way in this passage. By condemning him unfairly, they were, in fact, acting as wicked men. He was thus using their arguments against them. I think that's possible. I don't favor that view. I'm not sure what in the text would demand that. So anyway, other comments or questions? Anybody? So that's, I think, deals with this question of Zophar's possible third speech and why Job might say the things that he does say in chapter 27. Now, chapter 28 is a chapter about wisdom. And it's interesting. Job says several things about wisdom. Look at verse 13. Man doesn't really appreciate its value. It can't be bought. Even though man's able to dig deep into the earth and obtain precious metals and stones, you can't find wisdom that way. God is the one who has to declare it. Look at the summary of divine wisdom in verse 28. Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to turn away from evil is understanding. What does that sound like? Does that ring a bell? That statement? Good, Proverbs. That sounds like Proverbs. Proverbs 1, where the writer starts talking about the fear of the Lord. And he says very similar things to what Job has said here. Proverbs 1 and verse 7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. So, why do you think Job talks about these things? Why do you think he talks so much about wisdom and the fact that it's unobtainable through man's own efforts? Incidentally, this is a great chapter for vivid imagery. Did you read that? Look at verse 1, surely there's a mine for silver and a place where gold is refined. Iron is taken from the earth and copper is smelted from ore. Man puts an end to darkness and searches every recess. You know, got the underground mines and men take their lamps, their candles or whatever, and they go into to these shafts and they dispel the darkness of the earth. Man puts an end to darkness, searches every recess for ore in the darkness and the shadow of death. He breaks open a shaft away from people in places forgotten by men, by feet. They hang far away from men. They swing to and fro. What does that sound like? Being lowered into a shaft and the whatever container they're in, it sways as they go down deeper into the earth. The imagery is vivid. As for the earth, from it comes bread, but underneath it is turned up as by fire. Its stones are the source of sapphires, and it contains gold dust. That path no bird knows, nor has the falcon's eye seen it. The proud lions have not trodden it, nor has the fierce lion passed over it. So man can go where even some of the like the falcon who has this keen eyesight, she can't see down in the earth. And the proud lions, they don't go down, but man does. But he's setting it up, isn't he? Because ultimately, can man find wisdom by digging in the earth? Is he able to find wisdom by his own ability? Well, he's going to talk about, if you look down in, look at verse 20. He says, from where then does wisdom come? And where is the place of understanding? It is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the air. Destruction and death say, we've heard a report about it with our ears. God understands its way and he knows its place, for he looks to the ends of the earth and sees under the whole heavens to establish a weight for the wind and apportion the waters by measure. When he made a law for the rain and a path for the thunderbolt, then he saw wisdom and declared it. He prepared it indeed. He searched it out. And to man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. So God's revealed what wisdom is. I don't think Job is trying to say we're all stupid and we can't figure anything out in this world. We can't find, there's no wisdom to be discovered by man. But ultimately, wisdom comes from God. True wisdom. Man often thinks he knows what's going on. He thinks he knows how God operates, thinks he knows what life is all about, and he's often mistaken. He doesn't discover the truth. God is the one who reveals true wisdom. I think that's what Job's point is. How does that relate to this whole discussion that he has with his friends? Any ideas? Thoughts? How does Job's comments about wisdom and where it can be found, how does that relate to the dialogue he has with his friends?
I think that there is like a difference, like there is godly wisdom and then there's worldly wisdom. So like from the friend's perspective, they were speaking of, you know, worldly wisdom, but then Job was reminded this public wisdom.
Excellent. The friends were depending on their own wisdom, right? But our fathers, you know, we go way back, they said in one of the speeches. I forget which friend said this. And Job, you're kind of a latecomer to the whole situation. So they're proclaiming their ability to know, to have wisdom. And Job, I think, here is saying, listen, God's the source of wisdom. He's been rejecting the wisdom of the friends because it doesn't fit what even Job can see. So who's going to solve this? Who's going to have true wisdom? Well, it'll be God. He's the one who created. He's the one that regulates the world. And so he's the one who knows how he works in the moral matters of men. Well, that kind of sets us up, doesn't it, with the two speeches of for the two speeches of God. We'll leave that until later. But I think that's a good setup. All right, so question number 5. What contrast stands out as Job compared his past with his present? Boy, we need to read this. It starts in chapter 29. Job said, oh, that I were as in months past, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon my head, and when by his light I walked through darkness, just as I was in the days of my prime, when the friendly counsel of God was over my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were around me, when my steps were bathed with cream and the rock poured out rivers of oil for me, when things were good, when I went out to the gate by the city, when I took my seat in the open square, the young men saw me and hid, and the aged arose and stood. The princes refrained from talking and put their hand on their mouth. The voice of nobles was hushed, and their tongues stuck to the roof of their mouth. When the ear heard, then it blessed me. And when the eye saw, then it approved me. Because I delivered the poor who cried out, the fatherless and the one who had no helper. The blessing of a perishing man came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind, feet to the lame, father to the poor, and I searched out the case that I did not know. I broke the fangs of the wicked and plucked the victim from his teeth. Then I said, I shall die in my nest and multiply my days as the sand. My root is spread out to the waters, and the dew lies all night on my branch. My glory is fresh within me, and my bow is renewed in my hand. Men listened to me and waited and kept silence for my counsel. After my words, they didn't speak again, and my speech settled on them as dew. They waited for me as for the rain, and they opened their mouth wide as for the spring rain. If I mocked at them, they did not believe it, and the light of my countenance they did not cast down. I chose the way for them and sat as chief, so I dwelt as a king in the army, as one who comforts mourners. When I came into the room, the young men fled, and the aged men stood up in respect. When I spoke, people were quiet, and they listened to what I said, and they accepted it. But things have changed, haven't they? He goes on to say in chapter 30, here's how things are now. But now they mock at me, men younger than I. We have to understand that even though in our culture age is not given the same kind of respect, in Job's culture, in Old Testament culture, even in the New Testament period of time, age was respected. And Job is being respected as one who's aged, not just aged, but righteous. And people paid attention to him and showed him respect. But now what's happened to Job? Well, it looks like God's punishing him, at least in the minds of so many. And so he's now sick, and everybody's attitude has changed. But now they laugh at me, they mock at me, men younger than I, whose fathers I disdained to put with the dogs of my flock. Indeed, what profit is the strength of their hands to me? Their vigor has perished. It has occurred to me that I'm reading from the New King James Version. Once again, I have failed to change my reference, my translation after a study. So verse 3, what could I gain from the strength of their hands, men whose vigor is gone? Through want and hard hunger, they gnaw the dry ground by night in waste and desolation. They pick saltwort and the leaves of bushes and the roots of the broom tree for their fruit. Food. They are driven out from human company. They shout after them as after a thief. In the gullies of the torrents, they must dwell in holes of the earth and of the rocks. Among the bushes they bray, under the nettles they huddle together. A senseless, nameless brood, they have been whipped out of the land. What's all this about? He's describing people who basically have been outcasts in society. These are the people who are basically not doing anything with their lives. And Job says, now those people mock me. And now I have become their song. I am a byword to them. They abhor me. They keep aloof from me. They do not hesitate to spit at the sight of me. Because God has loosed my cord and humbled me, they've cast off restraint in my presence. On my right hand, the rabble rise. They push away my feet. They cast up against me their ways of destruction. They break up my path. They promote my calamity. They need no one to help them. As through a wide breach they come, and amid the crash they roll on. Terrors are turned upon me. My honor is pursued as by the wind, and my prosperity has passed away like a cloud. It goes to describe on to describe his personal feelings, his personal suffering because of the sickness that he's enduring. And now my soul is poured out within me. Days of affliction have taken hold of me. The night racks my bones, and the pain that gnaws me takes no rest. With great force, my garment is disfigured. It binds me about like the collar of my tunic. God has cast me into the mire, and I become like dust and ashes. I cry to you for help, and you do not answer me. I stand, and you only look at me. You have turned cruel to me. With the might of your hand, you persecute me. You lift me up on the wind, you make me ride on it, and you toss me about in the roar of the storm. For I know that you will bring me to death and to the house appointed for all living. Who's he talking to at the end here, these last verses? Is he talking to the friends? Yeah, he's talking to God. It's not the friends who are doing this to him. He believes God's doing this to him. So here's a guy who was up here, respected in the community. People listened to him. And now even the lowest of society, people that he wouldn't have put to watch his flocks in the past, those are the people that are making fun of him. And everybody's drawing away from him. They keep aloof from him. They'll make fun of him. They spit when he comes by. But nobody wants to be with him and to support him. Even the friends have been of no comfort to him. Yet does not one in a heap of ruins stretch out his hand and in his disaster cry for help? Did I not weep for him whose day was hard? Was not my soul grieved for the needy? But when I hoped for good, evil came. And when I waited for light, darkness came. My inward parts are in turmoil and never still. Days of affliction come to meet me. I go about darkened, but not by the sun. I stand up in the assembly and cry for help. I'm a brother of jackals and a companion of ostriches out in the wilderness. My skin turns black and falls from me, and my bones burn with heat. He's feverish. My lyre is turned to mourning and my pipe to the voice of those who weep. So chapters 29 and 30 are chapters of contrast. And Job is talking about what his life was like before and what it's like now. And you understand the despair, the distance that he has come down in society. No wonder he says some of the things that he says. Not, as Job would say, and I think Eliphaz said also, the counsel of the wicked is not with me. I'm not excusing what he said when he was rash. I'm saying, look at what has happened to this man. It's pretty easy to zip through chapters 1 and 2 and say, yeah, he lost all his stuff. Oh, yeah, and his kids were killed. And, oh, by the way, he's sick and he's you know, miserable. Got to understand where he came from in order to appreciate where he is now. Comments or questions? Anybody? That's quite a bit of reading, but I think you get a sense of what Job has lost here in terms of his relationship with others. Of what sins did Job declare that he was innocent? Now we're moving into chapter 31. Job has declared his innocence, at least in general terms, although he's been specific about some things, in previous passages, previous speeches. But now he's going to really move through chapter 31 and talk about a number. He's going to be specific about a number of sins that would be common among men and say, I'm innocent for these things. I'm going to just kind of look at these in categories, give a couple verses for each particular sin that he talks about. He talks about in the first four verses of chapter 31 about lust. He says, I've made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin? What would be my portion from God above and my heritage from the Almighty on high? Is not calamity for the unrighteous and disaster for the workers of iniquity? Who does that sound like? Yeah, that's what the friends have been saying. Job believes the same thing. He just understands at this point that there are some exceptions to that rule. Does he not see my ways and number all my steps? Job says, why would I look upon someone that I have no right to? I've made an agreement, a covenant with my eyes. I won't do that. It's a good thing for men and women to do today, because God sees all our steps. even when we're in the privacy of our own homes. Lying and deceit, he says, I didn't do that. If I've walked with falsehood and my foot has hastened deceit, verse 5, let me be weighed in a just balance. Let God know my integrity. If my step has turned aside from the way, my heart has gone after my eyes, and if any spot has stuck to my hands, then let me sow and another eat, and let what grows from me be rooted out. Let me suffer the loss of things if I've taken things from others, if I've lied or been involved in deceit. He talks about adultery there in verses 9 through 12. If my heart has been enticed toward a woman and I have lain in wait at my neighbor's door, in other words, here's my neighbor and he's married, and so I'm over there spending time with his wife, I'm waiting at his door for opportunity for adultery. He says, then let my wife grind for another and let others bow down over her. Now that's euphemistic for saying, then let somebody else take advantage of my wife, if that's the way I've been. In other words, if that's the way I've treated my neighbor, then let it happen to me as well, I think, is the concept. For that would be a heinous crime. That would be an iniquity to be punished by the judges. For that would be a fire that consumes as far as Abaddon, and it would burn to the root all my increase. Adultery destroys lives, what Paul's saying. Job. I got to stop reading the New Living Translation. Misuse of power, verses 13 through 15. If I've rejected the cause of my manservant or my maidservant, those would be people under his authority, when they brought a complaint against me, what then shall I do when God rises up? God hears their complaints. When he makes inquiry, what shall I answer him? Did he, not he who made me in the womb, make him, that is, the maidservant or the manservant, and did not one fashion us in the womb? Same God that made that person made me. What will I say when God calls me on the carpet for how I've treated? Neglect of the needy. Paul says, I've taken care of the needy. Abuse of justice in chapter 31, verse 21. If I've raised my hand against the fatherless because I saw my help in the gate, then let my shoulder blade fall from my shoulder. Let my arm be broken from its socket. What does he talk about the shoulder and the arm? That's the part of your body that you would use to help somebody. If I haven't used that part of my body to help other people when they needed it, then let that fall off of my body. We could go on, abuse of justice there. He talks about materialism. If I've made gold my trust or called fine gold my confidence. Idolatry, if I've looked at the sun when it shone or the moon moving in splendor and my heart has been secretly enticed and my mouth has kissed my hand. That's the idea of worship. Proskuneo is to kiss toward, the idea of worship. If I've been worshiping the astral bodies. What's interesting is the way that he talks about all these things, these sins, talks about bitterness and spite. And that was the next question, I believe, question 8, if I remember, 7, if I'm remembering correctly, yeah. How did Job declare himself innocent of all these sins? Well, if you notice, for instance, well, I've got an example that I'll use the example that I used here. Look at verses 21 through 23. If I have raised my hand against the fatherless, because I saw my help in the gate. Do you understand what that means? When there were disagreements or judicial cases, that would go to the gate of the city. It was not just a door or a gate. It was an area that was the entrance into the city. And that's where a lot of business was conducted. Both commercial business, but also judicial business. And so Paul, Job says, if I've raised my hand against the fatherless, that would be the orphan who doesn't have a father, a parent to defend him, because I saw my help in the gate. So I come to the elders of the village, and I want to take advantage of this orphan, and I know that the people in the gate will help me. Job says, if that's what I did, then let my shoulder blade fall from my shoulder and let my arm be broken from its socket. For I was in terror of calamity from God and I could not have faced His majesty. Job says, if I did that, then let this happen to me. Why would you say that if you thought you were even close to being guilty of that kind of sin. So he pronounces curses upon himself if in fact he has done what apparently the friends think he had done, that he had taken advantage of people, sinned in all these different ways. He says, nope, I'm innocent of those things. You have to understand the methodology of his protestations of innocence. If I've done this, then let this happen to me. Well, nobody in their right mind would pronounce a curse on himself unless, of course, he was confident that he was innocent and that curse wouldn't fall on him. Does that make sense? Okay. So that's really the summation of chapter 31, is that he's protesting his innocence. We've already actually read through the text that deals with question 8, so I don't think we have to go over that. Question 9, list the passages. Oh my, we couldn't do that. Not in the time that we have. So we've read many of them. I'll leave that for you. We're going to go into lesson 10. Be aware that very shortly there's going to be a sign up for the next class. This is simply a single session study of Job. So lesson 13 is the last lesson. It'll be a comprehensive review. What we will do in that is a crossword that will allow us to kind of review all kinds of different things. Well, I'm thinking crossword. I'm fairly certain that's what I'm going to do. I haven't written the lesson yet. I mean, Debbie hasn't written the lesson yet. So when she gets done with it, then we'll know what it is, whether it's a crossword or a Bible Jeopardy game. But appreciate your attention this morning. What we're going to do in the next class is we're going to hear from another person who's been listening to all of this dialogue between Job and his friends. His name is Elihu. He's a younger man, and he is anxious to speak. So that's what we'll be talking about in lesson 10. I was just going to ask if you knew.
A little soreness under one side on Sunday. Jennifer's working on
it. Is she?
So they're doing x-rays on her ribs to make sure it didn't break anything, but she's okay.
Yeah, that's the concern, is that sometimes something will happen and you don't really know that you hurt yourself until
later. They didn't
think
they needed to do. It's kind of surprised they didn't put a cervical collar. They're usually told to people they do that right away. No, they don't.
Yeah, sure. Unless they find something, she's not even there. Yeah.